I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the deliberately alarmist Yale historian Tim Snyder. He's got 20 little pills he wants you to take and to keep taking, perhaps to save your country. The stark premise he laid out for us a month ago is that the real project of Donald Trump and company is regime change. When they mock the legal restraints of so-called judges and call journalism the opposition, we should understand that they're test marketing their contempt for the rule of law and the constitutional protection of critical freedom. So Tim Snyder has written out his pocket-sized Get Real manual. It's called On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. These are the warnings that Europe did not hear in the 1930s. Warnings that still grate on American ears today, but try them out. Read books, Tim Snyder says. Make eye contact and small talk. Put your body in unfamiliar places with unfamiliar people. Consider using alternative forms of the internet, or simply using it less. Realize that email is skywriting. Everybody sees it. Have personal exchanges in person. Be alert to the use of the words extremism and terrorism. Set a good example of what America means for the generations to come, Tim Snyder says. They're going to need it. One sidelight that fascinates me here has to do with President Trump's Russiagate. Tim Snyder's not much worried that Vladimir Putin's hacking tipped our presidential race in 2016. But steeped in the horrible history of 1930s Europe, Tim Snyder is alarmed about every tolerant gesture President Trump makes toward Putin and his Russia. He's saying to us, the way the Russian system has worked since Putin's elevation to power in 1999, episodes of terrorism have been used at every step to do away with democratic and liberal institutions and to replace them with an ever harsher and more effective authoritarian regime. So, when Donald Trump sweet-talks Vladimir Putin, Tim Snyder is telling us we should be seeing his Russia as a possible negative future for the United States.
I come from this country. I grew up in this country. I'm from the Midwest. I did pretty much every stereotypical American thing one could do, you know, right down to the apple pie. But when I look at the U.S., I look at it intellectually, morally, from the perspectives that are professionally clearer to me, which are the history of Central and Eastern Europe in the first half of the 20th century, and then also contemporary East European political life. So when I watched the 2016 campaign, I, of course, was a bit surprised by it, like everybody, but I also saw a series of markers which to me were rather familiar than unknown. I was surprised by the outcome, but it wasn't that I was in a lather upset. It was more that I thought that I could do something. And writing the 20 lessons on the 15th of November, which became the book that I finished before Christmas, was the thing that I could do. I mean, it made me feel better, but it was also a way of channeling or releasing all the things that I thought I understood about Eastern Europe, historical and contemporary, into an American discussion, which had to start sooner rather than later. And so in some sense, like, what I was saying about how to understand the moment is in the mix of the moment from the beginning. I can't really separate myself from it. But I would say that basically my sense that we should understand this in big, broad, conceptual categories and not get caught up in the day-to-day, I'm very sure that's right. And one bit of evidence that it's right is that the 20 points I wrote in November before anything had happened, I mean, 2 months before he became president, and people are reading it now and saying, oh, aha, that lines up. That corresponds to the things that are happening. And that's because the things that are happening correspond to deeper patterns. And if we're going to act sensibly, we have to figure out what those deeper patterns are.
I'm wondering, are we sleepwalking still? Is there something to be said for a roused citizenry, a newly important or self-important media, for example, some of it?
Yeah, there are things that are very encouraging. And, you know, as you say, better than I would have expected.
Where better, where worse?
So better in terms of speed. So I have this slightly East European perspective that Americans are extremely slow and complacent, and they need to have everything served to them before they react. And I think that is true of us, unfortunately, to a great degree. But in the airport protests of the Muslim ban, we saw speed and coordination. And in the marches, we saw numbers, but also we saw intelligence. And we saw people who were coming from different kinds of backgrounds and different kinds of political perspectives, communicating with one another effectively, talking to each other in real life, you know, writing fantastically intelligent signs. That was better than I would have expected. Oh, also lawyers. my comparison is always the 1930s. And in the 1930s in Germany, which was a rule of law state, you have a fantastic collapse of the lawyering class. With a few bright exceptions, you have the escape of Germany from law as a kind of universal idea and the embrace of the notion that the law is just what's good for us, which leads you down an abyss. I mean, literally down an abyss. Hans Frank, who was the governor general of Poland, was Hitler's personal lawyer. Many of the commanders of the Einsatzgruppen who carried out the murders of Jews in the East were lawyers, right? So now lawyers, as I see it, I mean, it's a weird perspective perhaps, but they have their second chance. I mean, the great rule of law state of the 21st century is the United States. I think the basic thing that some lawyers are getting right is the idea that law, regardless of an individual decision, like law with a capital L, is a normative enterprise which stands apart, at least in some way, at some distance, from the politics of the day. That's the spirit of the letters from the heads of law schools, and that's the spirit of a lot of the legal activism that one is seeing. On the bad side, though, would be televisual media, or most of it, which preserves this kind of day-to-day, let's just wait to be surprised, the idea of the breaking news where nothing ever actually breaks, the developing story where nothing ever actually develops, right? That's on the bad side and remains so. The polarization, which is generated by the internet, has not yet been overcome in real life. We still have two hard cores of citizens whose opinions are basically formed in virtual reality, who are not talking to each other enough in real reality. So, you know, in some ways things are better, in some way things are worse than they were in the 1930s. You know, and I would never maintain that's the same. But what, you know, the big difference is that we have the retrospect. We can look back and say, okay, it can fail, and therefore we need to act now. We've got that, and I have been all in all pleasantly surprised that many Americans seem to have learned that lesson.
Tim, there's so much good advice in these 20 points, but a lot of it makes me want refinement. You tell people to watch their words and listen hard to the words that are being used. And you mentioned terrorism. That was an act of terrorism. This wasn't, or whatever. But I also think, what's the history of these abuses? We've been misusing terrorism getting on for 20, 30 years now, certainly since 9/11. We never see our own predator strikes as terrorism, and we take the politics out of the 9/11 attack by simply calling that blanket terrorism. Revise the catalog of words to watch out for.
What you're talking about is a lesson towards the end of the book, which says to listen for dangerous words. And the ones that I specify are exception and emergency. And then the examples I give come from terrorism. Now, this is a book which is very specifically about what Americans in 2017 might learn from Europeans of the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. That is, I'm trying to take a set of cases which are sufficiently distant from us that we might be able to get some traction and perspective from that distance precisely on our own case. Now, on terrorism, yeah, of course, it's the case that in 2001, we used an act of terrorism in the United States to justify a war which had nothing to do with that act of terror. And, you know, the people who were in power at the time abused the understandable force of that word and that concept and that experience in New York and Washington and elsewhere to bring about events which killed far, far, far more people and which, in fact, among other things, spread terrorism much further than the authors of 9/11 could have ever hoped that it would go. Okay. But here's what I would say now. We're now in a situation where a president facing an act of terror could also use it as a justification to completely undo the constitutional order in the United States, right? For all the legitimate criticisms one would have of our reaction to 2001, if there was a terrorist attack in 2017, we now have a president who is temperamentally and morally very different from George Bush. We have a president who has not even given nodding recognition of the rule of law and democracy. We have a president who openly admires other people, such as Putin or Assad, who have used terrorism precisely to undo the rule of law and install authoritarian regimes. So we're in a different and worse place than we were in 2001, unfortunately. And we need to recognize that there is something worse that can happen. And we need to prepare ourselves to mobilize to defend the constitutional order in the United States after a terrorist attack.
Tim Snyder, I'm just reminded that I met you originally thanks to Tony Judt, a historian, a mentor of yours, a man whose work means hugely to me, especially those final books that you helped him get before he died of Lou Gehrig's disease, and especially one of them called Ill Fares the Land. In that book, he says, we must act on our intuition of impending catastrophe. This was more than a decade ago. But also, he pointed to fundamental things that I don't ever let go of. What's wrong with our society? It came down to three big categories in Tony Judd's analysis. A money culture of money worship in our institutions, in our undergraduates. Secondly, that we're letting go of a social democracy, the reality of a welfare state, but also the values in it. But all third was what he called a dilapidated public conversation, sort of media silliness, entertaining ourselves to death and all that sort of thing. How do we remember those warnings in the light of the panic around the new ones?
The interesting thing about Tony Judd, for me, and in relation to this little book on tyranny that we're talking about, is that Tony came to befriend, came to represent, and in some ways came to imitate East European intellectuals whose primary preoccupations had to be simultaneously political as well as intellectual. In other words, with historians, sociologists, who took for granted that in addition to their scholarly engagement, there would have to be political engagement because of the reality of authoritarianism. We now face the threat of authoritarianism, and you're quite right that Tony was always alert, ahead of everyone else, generally, to the problems. I think the fundamental insight that Tony had about social democracy has to do with fear. In order for people to be confident, self-knowing individuals who take part in a republic or who vote in a democracy, they have to have a certain baseline level of fear and anxiety, which is low enough that they're not so constantly afraid that they can't make decisions about their own long-term interests. And that's what social democracy is all about. I mean, social democracy is primarily about generating a middle class in the American sense of the word,
right,
a big, broad middle class that feels like society and politics belong to it, and that each individual has a role in society and politics. That's what social democracy is for. It's for creating the social conditions in which democracy is possible. We in America are afraid all of the time. And, you know, too many people who voted for Trump because they thought, here is somebody who, by his person, can somehow resolve all of this fear. And that's a shortcut that never works. The only thing that can resolve fear are institutions, which not only make war less likely, but that make education something we can take for granted, that make healthcare something we can take for granted, that make pensions something we can take for granted. When those things are resolved, then people have the mental space, the psychological capacity, the emotional ability to think about their own interests, the interests of their families and friends over the long run. So this issue of social democracy is directly related to whether we survive as a democracy. And that's something that, you know, I think Republicans might want to be giving a thought to as 2017 begins.
Tim Snyder, those people, a lot of them voted for Trump in a kind of anxiety. What they got, it turns out, was Steve Bannon. And that story is still emerging about what he believes, what he fears, what he intends, what he's saying to the president. This is a man who's never written a book. He hasn't put out a manual of his nightmares, as you have. Help us out. We're just getting to know his mind, but what I'm really interested in is, what's the counter theory that we should be learning of how the country, how the society, others in the world came to the distress that they're in?
I can't imagine that there's a precedent in American history, although no doubt someone who, you know, is an American historian will correct me, for someone of whom we know so little having so much power.
Right.
This is really a rather extraordinary situation. And I mean, before I get to the population, let me say the thing that strikes me about Mr. Bannon, which is I think in him and in the texts which he seems to prepare for Mr. Trump, we have an alternative nostalgia, which is not conservative, right? So if I understand conservative nostalgia in the U.S., it has something to do with the period before the 1960s, you know, the kind of idealized 1950s, before the hippies, before the pill, you know, before the war, when people worked hard and knew their place and so on and so forth. What's striking about Mr. Bannon and Mr. Trump is that their nostalgia lands in a different place. It lands in the 30s. Which is, you know, only 20 years before, but actually hugely different. And how do they go back to the 1930s? I mean, Mr. Bannon says he wants to bring us policies that are as exciting as those of the 1930s. Mr. Trump uses the term enemies of the people, which is from Joseph Stalin. Mr. Trump chooses, or Mr. Bannon chooses, I'm not sure which, to make the theme of the inaugural address America First, which is, as they both know very well by now, precisely the main slogan of people who wanted to keep us out of the Second World War and who opposed FDR. And that's the crucial issue right there. The difference between the 30s and the 50s is, do you accept the FDR legacy or not?
Right.
The legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt is anti-fascism and the beginnings of the welfare state.
Right.
If you're nostalgic about the 50s, you're accepting that we should have fought the Second World War, that that was the greatest generation, and you're accepting, albeit maybe grudgingly, that there should be some kind of American welfare state. Once you go back to the 30s, all that is up for grabs. Most Americans didn't want to fight the Second World War. There wasn't a social welfare state until FDR started one. And it's something which I don't really think that many Americans would be so sympathetic with if it were put quite so clearly as all of that. Most people who voted for Trump were actually just Republicans who wanted to pay less taxes and didn't worry that much about the fate of the country. But the crucial people we're talking about, the people who are not doing so well, are right to think that there's huge inequality in this country. They're right to think that that's a response to globalization. The crucial fork in the road is whether you think the fear that arises from this and the anxiety can be solved by one person charismatically putting a face on globalization and saying it's the Mexicans, it's the Chinese, it's the Jews, it's the whatever, or whether they say my anxiety is going to be best resolved by having access to healthcare, education, and so on for my children. That's the crucial decision, which I think is in front of people right now. And of course, in some sense, we all got unlucky because the guy who wants to shake things up is not always the anti-patriotic, kleptocratic narcissist. It's usually somebody a little bit less noisome and harmful than that.
Tim Snyder, I guess I'm wondering, for people who feel a kind of general anxiety about our public culture, about the working of our economy, especially on the equality measure, but also our place in the world. Steve Bannon has one rather forbidding, dark, and dangerous picture of it. What's the better one? Where do we go? I still miss Tony Judd, but he was just as worried as Steve Bannon. And he said, believe the bad news, believe the danger, and get ready to do something.
I mean, in thinking the 20th century, which is the book that I did with Tony Judd, towards the end, there's a chapter about truth, where the idea that we're working ourselves towards, and which actually also comes from some of the East European anti-communist dissidents, is that there's a danger in the big truths, the capital T truths, the simple answers to globalization, whether it's in the 30s or whether it's in the 2000s, whether it's the communist idea that globalization is a capitalist conspiracy or whether it's the Nazi idea that globalization is a Jewish conspiracy, the big T truths, the ones that create a narrative where everything falls into place, that's a problem. But that the answer, although it's less attractive and harder, is to care about the small T truths, the little things, the facts that you think with a little bit of hard work and help from people you trust who are also working hard, you can try to understand. And that seems to me a very important observation. Mr. Bannon clearly, and I think rather openly, believes, I mean, he says that, you know, darkness is his friend, his role models are Satan and Darth Vader, which is funny. If it would be funny in a different world anyway, maybe it'll be funny in 50 years. But, you know, Satan, Darth Vader, Dick Cheney, darkness. The whole idea is to keep people in darkness. In other words, he's openly proclaiming that the idea is to confuse us, to mislead us, or to lead us, rather, into a world where we don't believe there's any truth. That is terrifying because democracy depends on the rule of law. Rule of law depends on trust, and trust depends upon us believing that there is a truth. We don't have to agree about every fact, but we have to all accept that there is something like truth.
How do we argue about it? How do we get Bannon on the stand with other smart, concerned, interesting people of real learning and respect for truth? How do we thrash these things out?
I don't think that will ever happen because the approach of this administration is fundamentally one of deception, and not in the normal political sense. I mean, here we have untruth not as a tactic and not as a strategy, but as the final goal, right? Because if you can convince people there's no truth, then you've totally disempowered them. Because, you know, it's enjoyable for a moment to slide down into total relativism. It's fun. You know, as Germans found out in 1933, it's very tempting, it's enjoyable to do that downward slide. But once you hit the bottom, it's a greased pole, there's no way back up. Because once you accept there's no truth, you have no basis on which to criticize anyone else. And without criticism, there's no basis for change or for reform. Anyway, that's a long way of saying, of course, you're not going to get Steve Bannon out debating with Harvard Law School professors.
Or how about Yale historians?
Or Yale historians. That is never going to happen. They cannot have the courage for something like that. They have to hide in the shadows of their own making and try to extend those shadows as far as they can. That's what they mean to do. I mean, that's what they've said they mean to do. And in this case, I believe them.
You've planted your stake in this hugely interesting, murky argument around Russia and Donald Trump. You say he's been playing with Russian loans and money and intelligence for years, in fact. There are other people, good ones, smart ones, who worry that if Hillary Clinton had been elected, we'd be approaching a war with Russia right about now. Is there any sorting out of that big mystery?
I mean, first of all, it should be said, most East Europeans thought he had a chance because East Europeans recognized him. They recognized the post-factuality phenomenon because they'd seen it before. And they, and also people like Peter Pomerantsev, who writes about this, looked at Trump and said, yeah, I mean, that can work. And I would point out that Russian and Ukrainian journalists, you know, who I knew personally, came to the U.S. in October, November, and they looked around the Midwest and said, yeah, he's going to win. And they were right. And the pollsters were wrong, right? So there's good reason to keep Russia and Ukraine in mind when we think about ourselves. They had a kind of shambling, you know, inconsistent, not even clear among themselves set of reasons for why they were doing what they were doing, which had to do with their own domestic preoccupations. Putin, when he threw the elections in Russia of 2011-2012, explicitly blamed Hillary Clinton for the protests that followed. He said that Clinton gave a signal and everyone followed, which is, of course, totally ridiculous. But once you export democracy and say, okay, democracy is not something that's ours, it's something that's imposed on us by others, you can then follow that strategy out to disrupting democracy elsewhere. Because so long as there's democracy anywhere, especially in your neighborhood, it's a threat to you. Hence, you intervene in Ukraine. Hence, you also intervene in the European Union, in France, and now in Germany. Hence, you intervene in the United States. It's not that you're sure you're going to win. It's that you think, well, if I can disrupt things, if I can make them more complicated, that's going to be in my interest. That's the basic Russian approach as far as I understand it. But in any event, what we need to be worrying about with respect to Russia is not like Russia good, bad. What we need to be worried about is Russia as a certain kind of political solution that can be contagious, right? You can have a system where you have elections, but that those elections don't matter. You can have a system where the Constitution guarantees checks and balances, but the reality is different. You can have a system where the state is basically directed towards a support of kleptocracy on behalf of one family or a tight elite. That is an example that I would say is not attractive to people of the cast of mind, such as Hillary Clinton, but is attractive to people of the cast of mind as Donald Trump. And since Donald Trump is now the president, that's the actual thing that one should be worried about, Russia as a positive example. It's not just this sort of boring, like, yes or no question, did Russia throw the election or not? Did Putin and Trump meet personally or not? That's not really the issue. The issue is we have a president who regards the Russian system as a positive model. Therefore, we have to understand that model, how it works, how it can be contagious.
That's something I haven't heard, though, from him, that Russia and Putin are models of leadership. I've heard him say, and, you know, plausibly, that this is a man, we didn't choose him, but he could be a useful friend in this world. Do you stretch that evidence a bit?
No, that's a good example, because what he means in particular is Russia would be a useful ally in the war on terror. And in order to evaluate that claim, one can't just think, oh, Putin, nice guy, not nice guy, or as Bill O'Reilly puts it, killer, not killer. You have to think, how does the Russian system work? And the way the Russian system has worked since Putin's elevation to power in 1999, and this is an issue on which Masha Gessen and I actually profoundly agree, the way the system has worked is that real, fake, and unclear episodes of terrorism have been used at every step to do away with democratic and liberal institutions and to replace them with an ever harsher and more effective authoritarian regime, right? So when Russia talks about terrorism, what Russia is talking about is a means of changing a domestic regime, okay? If you know that, then you hear what Trump says about cooperating with Russia over terror in a different way. You hear it as a way of changing the regime in the United States as well. If you go after terrorism with the Russians, what that means is you're going after terrorism in order to change your own system. That's how and why they do it. And they also invent stuff that just didn't happen in order to change things around. If we're going to be serious on the left, we have to recognize that Russia represents the things we don't like. It has greater wealth inequality than we do, right? It has greater surveillance than we do. Not only do they surveil people, but they actually publish the things that people say, which is one step worse. Russia is a possible negative future for the United States. That's the cognitive value of Russia.
Tim, we love the lessons of history, even when they're ambiguous. We so appreciate this book. At the same time, you could worry reading the book and watching events that it's impossible to see these things in real time. And the Germans didn't, even at the Reichstag fire. Who were the Germans in Hitler time who saw what was going on and said and did the right things?
I think it's impossible to understand things in real time without reference to something else. You have to have some set of concepts. Hmm. And in my case, those happen to be historical concept. So I think to get a grasp on what's going around you, which is impossibly fluid and complex, you have to have a sense of patterns that come from elsewhere. And this is what the founding fathers said, right? So when the founding fathers drew up the Constitution, they generally thought that it would be very hard for the Republic to last more than a few decades. And the reason they thought that was because they were aware of the examples of Greece and Rome, the decline of democracies and republics into oligarchies and empires. And that's why they wrote the Constitution the way they did, not to protect America from foreign dangers, but to protect America from Americans precisely. And I think it's a silly way to put it, but they would be surprised that their experiment has lasted this long. What I'm trying to do in the book is I'm trying to apply that wisdom, the skepticism about our own virtues, plus the use of historical precedents to where we are now. People in the 30s in Germany were not less wise than we are. In some sense, they were more wise. They certainly had longer attention spans. They read more books. Probably the average level of legal culture was a little bit higher, at least in 1933. But everything still fell apart the way that it fell apart. And I think that's where we have to start. That we learn that the one advantage we have is that we can look back on where people like us failed. Okay. Now, you ask me who tried to do things the right way. And the answer is, and it's a telling answer, the answer is very few people fast enough, because most of what happened in 1933 was normalization. Most of what happened was reacting to change by accepting that this was a new framework. And that's why the first lesson of On Tyranny is do not obey in advance. One of the profoundest things we learned from 1933 and from psychological research afterwards is that people are very good at adapting to a new situation and then telling themselves that they haven't done so. We have to be aware of that basic fact of ourselves and just not do it, just not obey in advance.
Tim, it is a scary book, but maybe we ought to be scared.
I can't imagine it frightens you. It's meant to inspire you.
We thank you, Tim Snyder.
Always a pleasure. Glad to.
Great. Thanks so much, Tim. Tim Snyder's little book, next to the cash register at a bookstore near you, is On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. There's more Tim Snyder on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Podcast Project.